Hi, this is Elmore Leonard. I'm listening to Film Sociology, and it's a real program. It's great.
It's time to hear what's good, what's bad, and what's ugly at the multiplex and the art house. What's new on video and streaming, and you might also hear about some dead people we like.
We don't have time for dead people we don't like.
Anyway, this is Film Sociology, where you'll find out what's the next cinematic marvel.
It was unbelievable!
And what's just a movie.
Shut up! My God, you have no freaking life!
Okay, here's your host and my dad, Matthew Soucy.
Hello there, film lovers. Welcome to Film Sociology, a film podcast here at WFYI.org. If you have a question or a comment, you can email me at msocey, that's M-S-O-C-E-Y, at WFYI.org. I'm also on Facebook, also on Twitter, at Matthew Soucy. This show is available on iTunes, and like all of the podcasts here at WFYI, available on Spotify. Well, friends, we got through another week. I've had a very, very busy week because on top of everything else happening here at WFYI and all things public radio goodness, I am in a play that opened on Thursday. It runs 2 weekends at Richmond Civic Theater in Richmond, Indiana. It is the stage play Miss Holmes, about if Sherlock Holmes was a woman and Dr. Watson a female. So I will say, if you're a fan of Enola Holmes, then you will dig this. So it reimagines the Victorian world of Holmes and Watson. So very cool stuff. Anyway, you can go to gorct.org for all information. Friday the 20th, Saturday the 21st, Friday the 27th, Saturday the 28th, Sunday matinee on the 29th. So we'll get to that in a little bit. And we're going to dip into the archives and have an interview I did with Patty Glenn, who is the director of the show. I had her on, last year to talk about the Sherlock Holmes film Murder by Decree, which is her favorite. And we'll find out more about that in a little bit. So, and then we'll grab a pencil, of course, and find out what you've been watching. But I want to start with a film opening this week, the domestic drama called The Son. And this is the new film from director-writer Florian Zeller. He won an Academy Award last year for The Father, for the screenplay, along with Christopher Hampton. That's the film that got Anthony Hopkins the Best Actor Award. Hampton and Zeller team up again in this one. I don't know if there's going to be a third film called The Holy Spirit or The Holy Ghost, but based on his play, and it's a story. We have Hugh Jackman and Laura Dern, who are a divorced couple. Hugh Jackman has moved on to his next phase in life. He is married to a younger wife, played by Vanessa Kirby. They have a new baby. But Jackman and Dern's character are having problems with their teenage son, who is living with her, and he wants to live with dad for a while. And so that arrangement is made, even though it might throw a wrinkle in things, as you're going to guess with a drama, domestic drama like this. First off, kudos to Zen McGrath. He plays Nicholas, the son. The fact that he has a lot of work with Laura Dern, Vanessa Kirby, and Hugh Jackman and stands up to the plate. This is the first thing I've noticed him in, and he's very, very good. And all the performances are good in this. There's a couple, because anybody who has been a parent, and especially when you get through the teen years, you just hope for the best. There are moments where there's absolute bliss between Peter, the Hugh Jackman character, and Beth, the Vanessa Kirby character. And you think there's going to be that tension with stepmom and son. But there's those fun moments. And then there's fun moments with Peter and Kate, the Laura Dern character. Even though they're divorced, they still have some pleasantness to them with their situation. And there's moments where it even Nicholas says, when mom and dad are together, it's like a reunion. So there's a really lovely moments, and then all you have to do is have the camera go on Nicholas's face, and he's in another place. And you know, to quote my kid the first time they saw Hamlet, this isn't going to end good. And those moments, it's because we don't see the trouble coming. As parents, you don't, and as kind of filmmaker, as a film audience, you don't, for the most part. see these coming. Although once we get into the second half of the film, the film does telegraph itself a little bit. And I whether it's intentional or not, those are probably the only drawbacks. And I kind of blame that on the director itself. There's especially a moment near the end. We have flashbacks, but there's one scene in particular because the tone is completely different from everything else. And I suppose it's supposed to nudge the audience on what has actually happened, but it didn't quite work for me. There's a few moments watching this because as a parent, you're trying to figure out the puzzle, as is especially with Hugh Jackman's character what is happening? A kid who finds out that his kid has not gone to school for over a month, and he's having trouble with mom, and everything seems to be okay with mom when dad is talking to her, that sort of thing. And there's a few moments in the film, I hate to admit, that as a parent I thought it was going to turn into we need to talk about Kevin. It doesn't. But as the film goes on, we find out more and more about Peter, the Hugh Jackman's character, and what he was like growing up. Anthony Hopkins does come off the bench in this film to play, and he's just credited as Peter's father. And, Hopkins is fine. The character's not the best written, and I don't know if it's necessarily needed, because there is a confrontation of words between this father and this son, and it's the whole thing of the older generation thinks the younger generation after them are soft, and that's kind of what his representation is. And the Hopkins character admits, you want me to be the monster. And I don't think that's even needed. I think that would add a little more gray and mystery if we didn't have Peter's father in the film and we were trying to figure out what kind of childhood Peter had himself. We also find out that Hugh Jackman's character is a boy. Mom was dying. Dad was working. And so that's kind of sets the fuel for not only Peter, the Hugh Jackman character, dealing with his son, but also dealing with himself. So, for the most part, I mean, it's the review is good performances. Go see this for the performances, especially from the quartet of Jackman, Dern, Kirby, and McGrath. Just be prepared that there's a few moments that you, as an audience member, you could sit there and think, okay, I got it. To borrow a term from Ed Johnsonat, and I think it was in The Valley of Elah that he's used this term, there are moments where you feel like you're getting hit over the head, but it's with a cardboard tube instead of a hammer. So, The Sun, opening this week. All right, we have Dead People We Like, because we never have time for Dead People We Don't Like. Gina Lola Brigida. Yeah, it's fun to say. She was fun to watch. Of course, also came around the same time as Sophia Loren. You could say it's anybody, whether it was Jane Mansfield or Mamie Van Doren, who had to follow in the same era as Marilyn Monroe. That was kind of the case in Italy. But has an established cinematic track record in her own right in Italy as well as here in Hollywood with films like films like The White Line and A Dog's Life, A Tale of Five Women going from the early 50s, Four Ways Out, Wife for a Night, probably the first noted American film for me that I really enjoyed her in, and this is the John Huston film Beat the Devil from 1953 with Humphrey Bogart, Peter Lorre, Sidney Greenstreet, and it's kind of a wink and a nod and a jab at the Maltese Falcon and all the convolutedness of a caper. It's also one of those films that nobody had the copyright for it for a while, so you saw all these bootleg DVDs and cassettes of Beat the Devil. She also appeared in films like Cross Swords. She was Esmeralda in the 1956 version of The Hunchback of Notre Dame. She was the woman that was torn between Burt Lancaster and Tony Curtis in Trapeze. She was Sheba in 1959, Solomon and Sheba, Never So Few, Come September, Go Naked in the World, Women of Straw from 1964, Strange Bedfellows from 1965, Hotel Paradiso, The Young Rebel, The Private Navy of Sergeant O'Farrell, even into the late 60s, Buenos Aires, Mrs. Campbell. That's Stuntman, that Splendid November. Not the Stuntman, just Stuntman. The Lonely Women from 1973. And her last film credit was Mercutio from 2001, and that was happening, of course, in Italy. So salute to Gina Lola Brigida and producer Edward R. Pressman. Now, I always crack up when a film pushes the producer of the film, the guy who financed it, or the lady, the person who financed it. Ooh, not as sexy a sell for me as directors or writers. But going through some of the stuff that Pressman did, he put his stamp on it. He has his thumbprint on films like Sisters from 1972, Badlands, Phantom of the Paradise, Paradise Alley, Old Boyfriends, which I need to revisit, Heartbeat, The Hand, yes, the Oliver Stone film with Michael Caine, was an executive producer on Conan the Barbarian and The Pirates of Penzance, the Das Boot, Conan the Destroyer, Crime Wave, Plenty, Half Moon Street, True Stories, yeah, Masters of the Universe, Cherry 2000, Walker, Wall Street, Talk Radio, To Sleep with Anger, Blue Steel, Reversal of Fortune, Homicide, You're the Gun, Bad Lieutenant, Hoffa, The Crow, Street Fighter, Judge Dredd, City Hall, oh God, the 90s version of Island of Dr. Moreau, Crow, City of Angels, The Blackout, Endurance, Legionnaire, American Psycho, and probably the last, it's so funny, the Hebrew Hammer, I forgot he did that, Party Monster, The King, Thank You for Smoking, that's for you, Abdul, Amazing Grace, and Bad Lieutenant, Port of Call, New Orleans, and Wall Street, Money Never Sleeps. That was the last film of his that he produced, or was an executive producer on, that I actually got to see. So salute to Edward R. Pressman. Thanks for those. You're listening to Film Sociology, a film podcast here at WFYI.org. Over at IU Cinema, oh my gosh, tonight at 7 o'clock Friday, they're showing Triangle of Sadness, Ruben Ostrund's dark comedy that's just getting a Criterion release as well. But if you see this on the big screen, that's worth checking out. 10 o'clock, the Not Quite Midnight movie on Friday the 20th, Pee-wee's Big Adventure. Saturday the 21st at 4 o'clock, they are replaying Triangle of Sadness. And Saturday the 21st from 1972, The Seduction of Mimi. Tuesday the 24th, The Conformist, from 1970, 7 p.m. Thursday the 26th at 7 p.m., Virus Tropical. That is all happening at IU Cinema at the Keystone Arts, as the Art Craft Theater in Franklin this weekend. Friday and Saturday, 2 and 7:30 p.m., Blade Runner, The Final Cut. And then, Friday and Saturday, January 27th and 28th, 2 and 7:30 p.m., The Harvey Girls from 1946. All right, friends, let's grab a pencil and let's find out what you've been watching, and then we'll get into some video titles I watched, and then we will get into go back to the archives with my interview with Patty Glenn. We start with Doug, who writes, The Hollywood Review, Don't Bother to Knock, Bonnie and Clyde, The Autobiography of Miss Jane Pittman, and more prospective Oscar nominees from 2022, After Sun, The Batman, Blonde, Descendant, Fire of Love, and The Menu. Kim writes Amsterdam, Fisherman's Friends, One and All, and Issey and Ossie. Jamie writes Strange World, Lady Chatterley's Lover, Enola Holmes, 1 and 2, and The Pale Blue Eyes. Nick Rogers writes Plane, Skinkamarink, DOA, The Driver, Don't Open Till Christmas, Sick, Elvis, the 1979 Kurt Russell version, Tomorrow's Drivers, Joyride, and Auto Theft, Alco Beat, The Bottle and the Throttle, The Talking Car, The Last Prom, Safety Belt for Susie, Flesh Eater, I Like Bikes, But Highball Highway, Crossroads Crash, Duets, Fury, and FX and FX2. Nick chimes in. They were on a compilation DVD I bought for Abby as a gift, but we'd never watched. The student movies, I believe, about the dangers of driving. Lou Harry writes a YouTube short documentary about Sid and Marty Krofft, about a Sid and Marty Krofft indoor amusement park. Wow. Eric writes First Views, X, Beau Travail, Banshees of Inisherin, Tar, Town Like Alice, Kimi, and Bullet Train, and his rewatches were 7 Days in Maine and The 49th Parallel. Devin writes Whitney Houston, I Want to Dance with Somebody. David writes Metropolis and Wings. Robert Muggy writes Deep End, The Shout, We're No Angels, Bell, Book, and Candle, Abigail's Party, and Home Sweet Home. Molly writes The Menu, Batman Returns, Vengeance, and then I Tried The Princess but got bored and only lasted half an hour. That happens, Molly. It's okay. Robert writes Pale Blue Eyes and The Menu. Samantha writes The Menu. Britt writes Top Gun Maverick and Black Adam. Adam writes Body, Bodies, Bodies. Daniel writes Gone with the Wind, 3,000 Years of Lounging, A Man Named Otto, and Clute. Oh, Abby writes, this might be a couple weeks, but my sense of time has been a mess. Abby, it's okay. So long as you contribute to film sociology, it's okay. It happens. Ever since COVID, there are times we just lose track of time. The 1993 Three Musketeers, George of the Jungle, Fern Gully, and The Dish. Nikki writes Pale Blue Eyes, Skinamarink, Toy Story, Emperor's New Groove, and the first two Mission Impossible films. Michael writes The Alamo, The Pale Blue Eyes, White Noise, and the original Planet of the Apes. Dustin writes Sugar, a well-crafted film, part sports flick and part immigrant story. Yeah, and I really enjoy Sugar, Dustin. I'm glad you got to check that out. Yeah, sorry of a player, if I remember right, from the Dominican Republic who gets signed to a major league ball club and lives in small Iowa farm town and sending money home, that sort of thing. Really, really good film. David writes The Whale. Frank writes White Noise, Glass Onion, Only Lovers Left Alive, which may be one of the best vampire films ever. There's a lot of people that feel that way, Frank. It's very good. Good, and of course, anytime you get Jim Jarmusch films, that's always a good occasion. Taylor writes The Outfit, Glass Onion, Mr. Right, The Pale Blue Eyes, Ice Station Zebra, and Master and Commander. Judy writes The Whale. Abby enjoyed Zach and Mira Make a Porno, but didn't like Love Actually. Terry writes the original To Be or Not to Be. David writes Kate. Aaron writes Death the Smoochie. Gary writes Kentucky Fried Movie, Inside Out, Broker, Lord of the Rings, Fellowship of the Ring, Shalom Dolomite, Reefer Madness, a Riff Tracks treatment, Virus, City of the Living Dead, and Warriors of the Rainbow. Melissa writes Scream 2, Don't Worry Darling, and Daybreakers. Bill writes Pandora's Box. I didn't think I'd seen a complete film starring Louise Brooks. She was captivating. Thank you, Bill. Kevin writes Dirty Rotten Scoundrels. Mulveen writes Power of the Dog. Blythe writes Car Wash. Love Car Wash. That's good. Adrian writes The Ones Pretty Much Outside the Box. The Brothers Karamazov. With William Shatner as Alexei. Yeah, that's 1950s films if there ever was one. Martin writes No Time to Die. And finally, Ken writes Tucker and Dale versus Evil. So that's what you've been watching this week, friends. So hopefully you've been able to watch something that was good, that was new, or at least new to you, as well as falling back on old favorites. Okay, before we dip into the archives, I'll go over what I'm almost caught up with the box of videos. Box of discs. I know the struggle is real, but we start with opening my page. Oh, that's right. The documentary called From Kino Lorber, From Worst the First, which is the true story of Z100 radio in New York City and how in the summer of 1983, they were last in their market. And they did this was their whole campaign was they cleaned house. They were bought by a Cleveland communications company, and they were going to go from the bottom to the top, and they actually pulled it off. So it's, because I'm in radio, this was especially interesting to see the assemblage of players, people from Tampa and, this was just kind of a mismatched group of people. There's a little bit of Indianapolis radio represented in this film. But to see the folks that worked together and did the morning show and did the afternoon show, you know, where every shift, every show had a personality. Not necessarily Wacky Zoo Crew, although that is a part of this, but how everything got assembled. It also talked about how by 1977, radio had already been diversified. Disco had divided the open rock format. They were talking about in the early 70s, early to mid 70s, on a rock station, you could hear Led Zeppelin, Joni Mitchell, Motown, all on one station. And disco kind of divided that up. It became, you got disco stations, and then rock stations became very male-oriented, and it's never looked back. And then we get into the fact that in 1983, this was the second golden age of top 40 radio. So you have some names like Scott Shannon and the assemblance of the team that if you're into, I think even if you're not into radio, just the fact that if you're not in the business, I think you'll still enjoy this. It's a little over an hour, so you got that going for it. But they talked about getting guests in on their show. They made direct references to competitive stations, which is a little more acceptable, but not quite as done like it used to be. And also the fact that Z100 became a destination if you were in New York. You went and did the network morning shows, the national and the local ones. You appeared on MTV and you went on Z100. So anyway, interesting look at a piece of radio history that's still happening today. So Worst the First is out on Kino Lorber. Also from Cohen is a double feature by films directed by Raphael Silver. And the first one from 1978 is a prison drama called On the Yard. Very young John Hurd, who is a con artist who's been thrown in the prison and just adapting to the environment in which he lives. We have one prisoner that is running the yard, basically, has deals with some guards, and what happens when that system breaks down. Think of it as a less poetic Shawshank. And also the fact that there's something I don't think you've ever seen before in a prison film, but there was a group therapy session. But you see some young familiar faces in here. James Remar, Lane Smith, Joe Grifosazzi, the guy from who played the uncle in The Sopranos. It's a good look at, and they filmed this at the, I believe, one of the penitentiaries in Pennsylvania. Also on this is a double feature from Raphael Silver, is the film A Walk on the Moon from 1987. It is the summer of 1969, and we have a gentleman, young American, who is a Peace Corps volunteer down in Colombia, played by Kevin Anderson. And he goes down there to join a couple other volunteers, including Terry Kinney, for you fans of Steppenwolf Theater, one of the founders there, and how they bond, also have some issues of their own. And just trying to help out in this small town the same summer that that astronauts land on the moon. We can land on the moon, but these guys are having trouble building a water wheel for a small town in Colombia. So, and how smaller things can sometimes have a bigger impact. So just an interesting look at two films from Raphael Silver from Cohen and Kino Lorber, On the Yard from 1978, as well as A Walk on the Moon from 1987. Should also mention that Raphael Silver was also married to Joan Micklin Silver, who we talked about last week with her film Fish in the Bathtub. Another film that she's better known for, Chilly Scenes of Winter, is getting a Criterion release very soon. So it all kind of rotates connection. It all connects together in one way, shape, or form. Also from Kino Lorber and Cohen, the Rob Epstein, Jeffrey Friedman collection. Three very good documentaries put together. One from HBO called Common Threads, which was about the AIDS quilt and the stories of some of the people from the quilt, including an Olympic athlete from the 68 Games, one who was a father to a 12-year-old victim. a Navy man and landscape architect who was married to a woman and then became married to a man. So we get that as well as the history of the coverage of AIDS in the early 80s and the fact that, you know, President Reagan didn't even use the word AIDS until September of 1985. Even though by 1983, the number of cases was doubling, even tripling every 6 months. So, but yeah, heartbreaking look at the stories of the folks behind the quilt. Dustin Hoffman narrates it. This was done for HBO. So called Common Threads, as well as the 1992 documentary Where Are We? Our Trip Through America, where Rob and Jeffrey, basically two gay men from San Francisco who travel through the South. They shoot for 18 days and just interview people. They speak their minds. Sometimes they're funny, sometimes they're sad, but they're truthful. And, you know, one of the questions they commonly ask is, what is your impression of the city of San Francisco? And man, folks are frank. So anyway, it's, there was one old Southern woman who, when found out that they were from San Francisco, basically said, "We appreciate people from all countries," as if California was its own country. So anyway, but very honest look at American people. And they weren't ugly. They weren't nasty. They were just being honest. So that is Where Are We? Our Trip Through America. And finally, from 2000, the documentary Paragraph 175, which was about the German law against homosexuality and how that kind of got ranched up quite a bit with the Nazi Party. The Pink Triangles, of course. And back when the Nazis took over and Paragraph 175 came into even stronger effect, where rumor and innuendo were considered evidence. So we get to hear interviews with some of the surviving gay men in Germany after World War II, after the Holocaust. Some wanted to speak, and some wound up breaking down while speaking, and others did not speak. But yeah, just a heartbreaking and an ugly time in the 1940s. And so those three films, Paragraph 175, Common Threads, and Where Are We, are part of the Rob Epstein, Jeffrey Friedman collection from Cohen and Kino Lorber. Also on Kino Lorber is a documentary called The Bookkeepers. And this is the story of Dick Wall, who is the husband of author Carol Wall. Carol had written some columns for Southern Living and the Atlanta Journal, and she had written a book that had been published and unfortunately died a week before the publication of her memoir. So her husband, Dick, picks up the slack and goes on the book tour. Their son, Phil, is the one filming this, and you see the grind of an author, or in this case the author's husband, going to schools, bookstores, churches, community centers. And so we get to see the grind of that as well as the background with the Wall family. They were married for 43 years. They were married at ages 19 and 20, if I remember right. Her having to do the rewritings while they were ill, scheduled readings, and how, you know, you go to one major... there are times where the book tour is unpredictable. Yes, you have an event scheduled, and you go to a major city and hardly anybody shows up, or you go to a small podunk town and they all come out. You just never quite know. But it does have an excellent representation of the grind of the book tour, and I know people that have done this. It mixes in with the history of Carol and Dick Wall, and it turns out when it's all said and done, 130 events in 23 states. He gets to continue telling her story. And then we also, by the end of the film, get to see his next life chapter. It's a very moving film. And anybody who's been a writer and or committed or married with somebody for a long time, it'll touch you. So, and I don't mean like that. But The Bookkeepers from Kino Lorber. And also from Film Movement is 200 Meters, a film where we have Mustafa, who works construction on the Palestine-Israel border, lives in the West Bank, family lives in Israel, and it's title of the film, literally 200 meters away. He can get an Israeli ID, but he likes to use his own work visa, doesn't want one, likes going back and forth the work permit is he's able to use his work permit in order to visit his family. There's a really lovely scene where he and his kids are able to communicate via phone, and their lights in their window, or in his case, the patio. They're able, that's how close they are, but also how divided they are at the same time. And one day when his son is injured and taken to hospital, he can't cross the border because of a technicality. And then things get very complicated as far as paperwork, proper paperwork, improper paperwork, and the road trip with people you don't know. And in some cases, your life is at stake if you're in this car and something goes wrong. So pretty tense family road trip drama mixed into one called 200 Meters from Film Movement. And there you go. So that's what I've been watching this week. And we'll get some more titles next week. All right, let's dip into the archives. Here's my interview with Patty Glenn. She and her sister Kate run the Two Sisters Bookstore in the Depot District in Richmond, Indiana. Patty is also the director of Miss Holmes, which opened on Thursday. We have performances on Friday the 20th, Saturday the 21st at 7:30 p.m., Friday the 27th, Saturday the 28th at 7:30 p.m., and a final performance, a matinee, at 2 p.m. on Sunday the 29th. You can go to gorct.org for all the information. I have a cameo in the play. Don't come see the play for me. Come and see the story of Miss Holmes. My cameo, for my own self-indulgence, is right up there with Nicholson in Broadcast News, Connery in Robin Hood, or really to a certain degree, Patrick Stewart in Robin Hood Men in Tights. Anyway, here's my chat from 2022 with Patty Glenn. We talk about Sherlock Holmes in films, especially. I also had never seen Murder by Decree, so I wanted to share that with her. So here's my chat with Patty Glenn. Enjoy. Joining me on Film Sociology is one I'm happy to say has become one of the usual suspects on this show. She is co-owner of the Two Sisters Bookstore in the Depot District in beautiful downtown Richmond, Indiana. She is also the Wayne County president of the Silence Film Fan Club. Patty Glenn is on the line. How are you, Patty?
I am great. That is quite an introduction.
That's not a real organization, because Patty always tells me, first it was stop telling my dad to watch Silence, then my family, and then just stop telling everybody to watch Silence. So I have you on, Patty, because, and by the way, if you want to see performance art, it's when I come visit Patty at the bookstore, because it will be a two-person show for at least an hour. It's a lot of fun. But I found a film that you've talked about at of great praise, and one I had not seen, I think, from start to finish since it came out. But you said that Murder by Decree is your favorite Sherlock Holmes film of all time.
I
stand corrected. So I would say the floor is yours. Present not your argument, just present your praise.
All right. So brace yourselves, listeners. Sherlock Holmes is literally my favorite thing to talk about, and Matt just gave me a microphone.
Whatever.
The first thing that I absolutely love about the film actually doesn't have to do with Sherlock Holmes, but has to do with, like, crime fiction in general.
Okay.
And it's, there is an aspect of crime fiction that, like, started way back with the ancient Greeks, with, of all things, Oedipus.
Wow.
And the idea behind it is that, like, a crime occurs, and it's because an injustice has been committed that is so unjust, for want of a better word, that it literally pollutes society. And so you have to have this outsider who comes in and fixes it and restores balance. And, like, the Greeks called it a miasma. This film is, like, one of the few crime films I've seen that I don't think that's what they were going for, but they managed to, like, get that. Like, because you feel uneasy watching this film. And it's a very wonderfully atmospheric film. I love that about it. The other thing that I really, really love is actually their Sherlock Holmes. One thing that we tend to like not have in a lot of post-World War II Sherlock Holmes adaptations is the concept that he's actually a pretty moral guy. His ethics are funky, but he's very moral.
Mm-hmm.
And, like, that is this Sherlock Holmes. And I've never seen another person portray Sherlock Holmes in that manner before. Like, that whole scene at the end where he yells, well, British yells, so it's, like, sarcasm and, like, really, like, just a pointed tone.
Right.
Like,
curtly, yeah.
Curtly, yeah. Just, he's very firm in his statements. at the politicians is, like, that is spot on Sherlock Holmes. Like, he does that in the books, and we tend to kind of not have that in a lot of adaptations because I think modern people kind of are like, oh, moral characters are boring, and he's intelligent, so he should be this, you know, sociopath or something. And you're like, no, he's actually, you know, that's actually pretty accurate to the books. Plus, James Mason is just a wonderful Watson.
Yes.
And then James Mason.
Just let folks know, Christopher Plummer, so there's that Canadian training, plays Sherlock Holmes.
Yeah.
And yeah, why does Watson sound like James Mason?
Yeah, no, he was a phenomenal Watson. I actually would argue he's one of the best Watsons. He was great.
I also think it's
funny that, like, that film got made in 1979, and then there was, like, another Jack the Ripper movie made in that same year.
Time after time. Yes.
Which I think would be a wonderful, like, doubleheader feature film thing to do.
We'll work on that. I got to watch Time After Time in my film genre class at the Ball State University. Thank you to Dr. Wes Gehring for showing it to us. It's Malcolm McDowell as H.G. Wells. He has a time machine, and he winds up having it is stolen by Jack the Ripper, played by David Warner. And he goes and he winds up in San Francisco, 1979. Wells strikes a relationship with Mary Steenburgen's character, and they wound up getting married in real life. There's Jack the Ripper in a disco because it's 1979. It's a lovely piece.
Amazing.
Yeah, it is. And also the fact that at that time, anytime you could get a Malcolm McDowell in a non-psychotic role, because that was kind of that became his pigeonhole, his kind of bread and butter. And he's lovely in this. And this one, I wanted to ask you before that, what was your history with the Sherlock? I mean, were you the I think we all kind of grew up in one way, shape or form with the Basil Rathbone, Nigel Bruce's, because those were on TV constantly.
Mm-hmm. I remember the very first one I ever watched, and it was The Scarlet Claw.
Okay.
And, like, I was, like, 8, maybe? And, yeah, we rented it from, my dad adores Basil Rathbone, quite rightly. and so he rented, I remember we went to the public library, and they had them, and we rented them on VHS tape. And I remember watching it, and I remember being absolutely terrified of, like, the Scarlet Claw itself,
mm-hmm.
which is this, like, garden tool. And, like, to this day, I'm still uncomfortable around those garden tools. But then, like, I saw it later, and I was like, this is not as scary as I thought it was.
But you dig for a living.
Yeah, I know. We use shovels.
That should be your signature tool. Just, you know, face your fear and confront it and make it the Scarlet Claw.
No. But yeah, so I watched those, and then I enjoyed them so much that my father had a copy of the complete Sherlock Holmes, Volume 1, which little me did not realize it said Volume 1.
Is this like First Annual?
You know, it's this fun little story where my parents returned home to discover that I had finished the book, which ended with the final problem. And I was, like, sobbing because I thought Sherlock Holmes was dead.
Oh, jeez.
Like, my mom had to take me out to the library and get me Volume 2. So that, like, yeah.
I'm sorry, did you mean The Final Solution, or is that a different title, The Final Problem?
It's The Final Problem.
Okay, sorry.
The Final Solution of it is the Nazis.
Right. And, well, but that's because, well, as I'm looking through Wikipedia, thank you, Internet, that Murder by Decree is influenced by Jack the Ripper, The Final Solution. So I'm sorry, I didn't want to get the titles confused.
No, Jack the Ripper, The Final Solution was, a, I if I remember correctly, it's like a history book that some guy wrote where he was trying to prove who Jack the Ripper was.
And apparently they blamed the Masons. Not James Mason, yes. The Freemasons.
The Freemasons, yes. That was a thing at the time. It is interesting that, like, in terms of Sherlock Holmes, Jack the Ripper is never mentioned in any of the Sherlock Holmes stories.
Right.
Which is weird, because, like, Conan Doyle's writing during that time period, and it's, like, why do you never mention this very, very, very important murder spree that's going on? But yeah, after reading all the books and that sort of stuff, I then was PBS. They had all the Jeremy Brett ones, who is, to this day, my absolute favorite Sherlock Holmes.
Okay, all right.
And then it just kind of took off from there.
And I also remember around the time for me was in the early incarnations of HBO, they would often film stage productions, and there was Frank Langella playing Sherlock in the late 70s, early 80s.
That sounds amazing.
I think this was like right after doing Disco Dracula with the, and what I mean by that, friends, the 1979 John Badham film. The Gentleman Who Gave Us Saturday Night Fever, so Dracula has feathered hair and an open shirt, and I think...
It's a good Dracula.
It is a love story. It's the love story portion of Dracula compared to the others. And, you know, everyone's second favorite Van Helsing, played by Laurence Olivier. he got more money. Anyway, so that was happening around the time as well. So this film, 1979, is directed by Bob Clark, who is a cult cinema director, if there ever was one, although you see his films every year because he directed A Christmas Story, the original Black Christmas, the first Porky's, and if you look at his film career, it's quite eclectic of stories he gets to tell. And I remember watching this, and it's, you know, it's supposed to be almost a battle of the titans between Sherlock Holmes and Jack the Ripper. One of the things that Clark does is the wandering camera, which became which was already a staple in slasher movies by the late 70s, and it was I think to a certain degree a nod to his film Black Christmas, which is, I believe, the film that introduced us to the concept the call is coming from inside the house.
Really?
Yes, so you can thank/blame. And the original Black Christmas with Olivia Hussey and Andrea Martin and Margot Kidder and John Saxon, that's an underrated slasher film if you're into that sort of thing. But what was interesting about watching this film, it's got an all-star cast, and it was used very economically. It's like, we have so-and-so for a couple of days, and because there's Plumber and Mason, but then you have David Hemmings as Inspector Foxborough, Susan Clark is in this, Frank Finley, Anthony Quayle, Donald Sutherland, Jonvia Bougeau, John Gielgud, and none of them have scenes together, unless they're with Plumber or Mason. So it's like, okay, we got Sutherland for 2-3 days, let's shoot his stuff. It was very economical.
It is almost like a Muppet film cameo. Real, but, you know, very serious. I remember watching this film and just being like, oh my gosh. People just kept popping up, and it's just this who's who of people.
Okay, because you mentioned it, Kermit's got to be Sherlock, Fozzie's got to be Watson.
Oh gosh, yeah.
And everybody else are humans.
Yeah. that was a wonderful meme thing that I saw online, that somebody sent me, that was the take any movie and replace all but one of the actors.
Correct.
With Muppets.
Yes.
Like, yeah, it's wonderful.
What is your favorite?
Oh gosh. I think there was, it was the Pride and Prejudice.
Oh God. Who do you keep? Colin?
Keep Mr. Darcy. All the rest are Muppets. There was one other one where I was like, yes, brilliant. But I forget what it was.
There are two that I have. And one that I have to thank my wife for bringing up. She, because of the amount of classic literature that the Muppets appeared in, sometime my wife misspoke and said Muppet Glass Menagerie. So here you go. Yeah, this is easy. This is easy. So Amanda is Piggy. Piggy is Amanda. Fozzie's the gentleman caller. Janice is the daughter. Oh God. Mm-hmm. Or no. What? No. Lynn wanted Janice to be the daughter. I wanted Emma Watson to be the daughter. And then Kermit, of course, is Tom. So that's not bad. My other one is you keep Ralph Fiennes and Schindler's List.
Mm-hmm. Yep. So. That's the thing, is it's always best to keep like the absolutely dead serious actor.
Yeah. Total. Yeah. So all right, back to Murder by Decree for a moment. The other thing about this film, and I'm sorry, spoiler alert on a 1979 mystery thriller. This has one of the more somber endings in a Sherlock Holmes film. We're used to him, I guess, solving the case, and they sort of do that here.
So that's the other funny thing, is that, like, that again is a lot of the stories where he, like, is kind of like, yes, and this was the solution, and Watson just goes, okay, so that's done. But yeah, it was. Like I said, like this is the very, like, the more moral variant of Sherlock Holmes. So, like, the ending is him kind of ranting at these politicians in the, you know, the British rant.
Curtly, yes.
Yeah, very curtly, explaining why it's a problem. But yeah, like it was, and then they did like that retrospective where they showed you the shots of the people with their names.
The curtain call kind of thing.
Yeah. Which was interesting. Like, that was, I don't think I've seen that done with a Sherlock Holmes film. So I really like that film. I would argue that my favorite Sherlock Holmes film is actually probably Without a Clue.
Yes. For those, it's Michael Caine as Sherlock Holmes, Ben Kingsley as Watson, and it's the theory that Watson's really the brains behind the operation.
Yeah, and it's, oh gosh, it's so funny. That film's hysterical. Although, if we're allowed to include animated films, it's hands down The Great Mouse Detective.
Sure, why not? It's your show. Your shop. It's your, you know, whatever.
I mean, I still have the days. There's all sorts of other ones. We've got, you know, like Young Sherlock Holmes, which is a wonderful little film that I was randomly introduced to. Which is like this weird mix of, because it's got Steven Spielberg and Christopher Columbus and Kathleen Kennedy working on it, and it has like the first fully CGI character in any movie ever. It's done by the people who make Pixar later, and that sort of stuff. And it's just this random little, what if Sherlock Holmes were a kid?
So, what we've had now, and I'm surprised there hasn't been talk of a reboot, but will the next Sherlock Holmes be as swashbuckling as the last guy? That would be Robert Downey Jr.
I mean, maybe they've done everything from that to, you know, Sherlock Holmes in the 22nd century. So, like, why not? Sure, put him on a boat.
Another lower key, yeah, like a low key version of that. I don't know. We'll see. So yeah, that's look for Murder by Decree. The other one I had to bring up, because anytime Patty and I are chatting, we love to gently poke, and now we can call him Academy Award winner Sir Kenneth Branagh. good on him. He still doesn't have as many as Emma, but you know, it's a good start. But
happy.
Yes, he was very happy, so we like that. But another film that I had not seen from start to finish since I saw it when it came out in 1994, a film that I like to call Kenneth Branagh's Mary Shelley's Frankenstein.
Yes, that film.
And it's called that film for several reasons. One, it didn't do well. When it came out, it's a bit much. This film has more camera tricks in it than any other Kenneth Branagh film, and this man made a 4-hour Hamlet. And there's also an aspect of it, well, it ended something in his personal life, and the plot point involving the actors playing the character played by the actors also has a disturbing point, which we'll get to in a minute. Your thoughts on Kenneth Branagh's Mary Shelley's Frankenstein?
My thoughts are everybody gets one. I will grant Kenneth Branagh that was his film where you just I think every actor and director or whatever artist gets one film where you just kind of watch it and you're like, why did you do that? What's that? And I think that's his.
Yeah.
My kind of fun story with this is like I had saw it when I was in college and had that response like, what was that? And then one of my friends, like months later, texted me and said, hey, I found a movie by that Kenneth Branagh guy you like. And I was like, oh, really? Which one? And he goes, Frankenstein. I was like, no. And I had to then spend like several weeks being like, okay, listen, watch another one of his, any of his.
Yeah, any of his. Yeah. Dead Again or Peter's Friends, anything.
Like, do not base your opinion on that film.
Oh, heavens no. No. He's right at the time he made this, friends, he was coming off Henry V is the one that kind of put him on the map, at least here in the States. He's already known in the UK. Made Dead Again, which was a Hollywood picture, did decent, and then made Much Ado About Nothing, which really kind of elevated him as the art house darling. Him and Emma Thompson were the new art house English movie couple. And that got him to do Mary Shelley's Frankenstein, which I should correct myself. It made money, just not as much money as Bram Stoker's Dracula, because it was because of that. Coppola was a producer on this, and because of the success, they wanted to revamp the Universal horror stories. And this was Sir Ken's attempt. It was just kind of a mixed bag, I should say. I stand corrected.
It's very stylish.
And his hair is great. I mentioned Frank Langella's feathered hair as Sherlock Holmes. Yeah, you should see the mop Sir Ken is as Dr. Victor Frankenstein, who could, you know, when he's not trying to create life, is touring with some rock band from the 90s.
It was a choice. Like there's a lot in that film that was a choice.
No shirt, feathered hair. Flailing around in goo with Robert De Niro or his stunt double, I guess.
But yeah, no, that film was definitely a choice. But like I said, everybody gets one.
And this was it. And it
went on. Did all his things.
And then he wound up doing The Midwinter's Tale. Which is known as the Spinal Tap for the Shakespearean crowd, and then kind of doubled down and made Hamlet, which is for me a lot of fun for 4 hours.
When I watched it in college in class, like we watched the entirety of that movie, but we like had to break it up in between class periods. But I'm really enjoying the Hamlet, even though it's one of those films where like you watch it and then you never sit through it again because it's so long.
It is the only, Hamlet is the only film that I ever bought tickets over the phone. And this is, what, 1997? And to borrow a joke from Dennis Miller, I'm not on the phone this long with friends contemplating suicide. And there were rock concerts. Lynn and I saw this in Chicago. There were rock concerts easier to get in and out of. I mean, people were jumping and claiming seats. And, you know, it was a big cheer when the lights went down. There was an intermission. You could have had lighters and beach balls and all that stuff with this, since it had Sir Ken and half the Screen Actors Guild involved.
He is a wizard at getting people to be in his films.
it's a nice trick to have, is, you know, people want to work with you. So, and speaking of which, in this cast, one of the last acting performances from Tom Hulce, who became a producer, Aidan Quinn, Ian Holm. If you could say John Cleese is the original Snape playing a professor in this film. It's a rare dramatic role from John Cleese.
Gosh, I forgot he was in that.
Yeah. Yeah, very serious, very foreboding. And then Helena Bonham Carter, who plays Victor's cousin, And then, you know, literally has her heart ripped out, which is, I'll get to that moment in a little bit. Does her best Elsa Lanchester, and then in real life, they became a couple.
Mm.
A lot of that. I'm sorry, you were going to talk about the heart rip?
Yes, no, because less said about the other part, the best. But yeah, no, the heart rip scene, that was, I can handle gore in films. I'm not a big fan of it. But the heart ripping scene was a particular level where you're just like, what can
yep.
I just see? When I watched it for the first time, like I literally, like after that scene happened, like paused and got up and like made myself a cup of hot chocolate, processed this and came back. Because it was just, I was not expecting that at all.
No. But you know what? He had money in the budget for special effects. So of course he said, why not? This was a period in the 90s where my buddy Laura Jansen and I, we were obsessed with finding, whenever possible, movie-themed pinball machines. There was a Mary Shelley's Frankenstein pinball machine, and I played it, and I liked it very much. And and because it's the 90s, if you have to imagine, so there's the front screen itself with your score, and there's more digital readings now, and there would be a little 90s digital screen at the bottom of the front face. And as customary in pinball, if your last two numbers match the random numbers picked by the pinball machine, you got a free game. So in this time, they would come up with some effect, some logo, something to announce that, you know, what the matching numbers were. For the Mary Shelley's Frankenstein pinball game, the creature drives his fist into Helena Bonham's chest and pulls out a number.
Yeah, just no. I probably assumed that was the pinball people trying to, like, process.
I laughed so hard the first time I played that game and that happened. And I continued to keep playing it just so I could match numbers and see. So they used the most gruesome aspect in the film for a pinball machine. Way to go, guys.
I mean, I guess go big or go home. But, yeah. Like, that is actually, like, that scene is really what I remember of that film. That and, as you say, Kenneth Branagh's hair. That was a thing.
And he worked with, and Robert De Niro was the creature. He you know, early on in the film, he does, like, I think he has three lines with an accent, and then he loses it because he's dead and then brought back to life. And his part is fine. You know, he got top billing. Although there's a lot of him, like, walking through the snow. It almost felt like Mary Shelley's Cape Fear of the creature trying to get revenge on his creator, and sort of does to a certain degree. So yeah, so that's.
I will.
Go ahead.
I will tell you though, the greatest slip up of accent in movie, in my opinion, in movie history.
Uh-huh.
So have you heard of a film called Dead Seven?
Dead Seven? No, fill me. Remind me.
This is beautiful. It is a zombie, post-apocalyptic zombie, western film.
Let me see. I'm pulling it.
Written.
Oh my God! I'm seeing.
And starred.
Oh.
Starring Nick Carter of Backstreet Boys.
No.
As well as, like, a whole bunch of other.
Yes, I just pulled up. Actually, he didn't direct it, but he wrote it.
Oh, he didn't direct it.
Co-wrote it.
He didn't write it. Okay.
But no, I know. Here I popped up and I see Nick Carter and Joey Fatone. I'm like, no, you have mentioned this. You have mentioned this. This is.
No, this film is amazing. This film is amazing. I love this film. They do this song at the end where, like, all of the guys who were in the boy bands that are in the film got together and, like, made this song for the end. And
oh,
it is,
God.
Like, distilled 90s as this song. But one of the jokes that my sister found about the movie commented that there are seven accents going on in this film, and five of them are from Howie D. alone. Yeah, and it was beautiful. That was my favorite, like, in movie history, my favorite, like, shifting of accents, because it was, like, every scene he uses a different one.
So we out Costner's Costner in Robin Hood, Prince of Thieves. So, God, Dead Seven. Yeah, I'm glad you watched it.
No, everyone should see it. It's wonderful.
Okay, so
the people who made Sharknado were involved in it too.
You said that out loud. So.
It's just so people know what they're getting into.
Okay, that's pretty good. That's a pretty good vantage point there. That's good.
Yeah. Like when you introduce someone to Kenneth Branagh's Frankenstein, he mentions the heart ripping scene first.
Yeah. Okay. All right. Fair enough.
Yeah, no, like you always mourn someone. I think the other thing why it was so surprising is that like I cannot think of another scene in any other Kenneth Branagh film where he does something like that. He's usually a very safe.
No, I guess not. But I think his Douglas Fairbanks impression at the end of Hamlet, swinging with a rope and. You know, he's almost, you know, the only thing missing is putting his hands on his hips and going, ha ha.
Yeah, but that's art. Like, that's his. I think he just was wanting to experiment and like, kind of went, well, I'm never doing that again. And yeah, like, it's completely unexpected for Kenneth Branagh. I think the closest I have seen is the. In Death on the Nile, there's a bit where a body pops up in the big turny things, wheels.
Oh, okay. Yes. Yeah. No, you're right.
Yeah, like that is probably the closest he has gotten to doing another like graphic scene. And even that was really tame.
The Ken Branagh WTF moment. So there's one. We got two. For number three, you could have. Andy Garcia smoking a cigarette through his trach hole and dead again.
Yeah, that was a little weird.
That's a little weird.
It's still the it was definitely the heart ripping thing. It was like the biggest like, what are you okay? Concerned about your mental state there? Are you all right? Like
yeah.
But then it seems to have gotten that out of his system and went back to doing Kenneth Branagh stuff.
So since you brought it up, your thoughts on Death on the Nile?
I did like Murder on the Orient Express better.
Yep. I'm sorry. Death on the CGI Nile.
I definitely liked the Murder on the Orient Express better. I am a little biased towards liking Death on the Nile because it's one of my favorite of the Agatha Christie books.
Uh-huh.
They announced that he's making another one. And they said it's one of Agatha Christie's like lesser known ones, and so I'm rooting for Murder in Baghdad or Murder in Mesopotamia.
Now wait a minute, first off, Death on the Nile was my first Agatha Christie film I saw in the theaters, so I know the chronological order. That means he's got to do Evil Under the Sun.
Oh yes, I really, really like Murder in Mesopotamia.
Okay, all right.
It happens, I mean, again, that was on an archaeological dig, so bias.
No, that's fine. And I will say that... Go ahead.
I have seen one adaptation where they did justice to, like, the region that they're in, and it's this beautiful thing. But it was one of those where as soon as they announced he was doing one that's, like, not one of the big ones, I thought to myself, ooh, come on, like, you can do this. Like, you know, gorgeous vistas with this murder movie. Like, it would be great.
Okay.
But yeah, no, I did enjoy Death on the Nile, but like I said, I think Murder on the Orient Express was the better of the two.
Agreed. Now, if he keeps doing these little intros and outros like it's a James Bond film, this is going to push my argument for Helen Mirren to play Miss Marple. Sexy, older, red Ferrari. She can still garden and still make tea, but it's Helen Mirren as Miss Marple. Come on, friends, get on it. And I'm a terrible guy, so there's that. I'm speaking with Patty Glenn here on Film Sociology, one of the co-owners of the Two Sisters Bookstore in the Depot District in beautiful downtown Richmond, Indiana. How are things happening over at the Two Sisters?
Oh, they're doing great. We're finally managing to. For a while there, we were having shipping issues getting new stock in because it was stuck at the Canadian border. But now they've all come in and kind of at once. But we're actually a little strapped, so we've got tons of new stuff. We're about to put all that on the show.
Okay. Well, and we have to mention, because I think we're contractually, emotionally obligated to bring this, and then she'll get mad at us if we don't. Your sister has her second book of her trilogy, or never-ending saga. Please plug your sister's book. We love you, Kate.
We love you, Kate. My sister's book. So that is a steampunk fantasy novel. A history teacher from outer world falls through a portal into steampunk fantasy world, and he joins up with this incredibly eccentric crew of airship pirates.
As one would do.
Yeah, as you do. It has been performed before the crown heads of Europe.
That means it was at Fringe in Edinburgh, Scotland. I know, I was one of the chaperones.
And I was just there.
That's right.
But then actually, we've made the joke of casting that as a Muppet movie, it would be Martin. So it's The Misadventures of Martin Hathaway is the book. And so the main character, Martin, we argued would probably be Kermit. And then the actual human, the only human left in the cast would be whoever plays Basil. Who is the eccentric first officer. Yes.
That's good. That's very good.
Everyone else is a Muppet. It would be amazing. So Kate has written two of the books. She's in the process of writing the third. And since we're going to give her a shout-out, I'm also going to give the obligatory, hey, I've been reading your draft and it ends on a cliffhanger. Come on.
Wow.
Please finish the book. They just bought a house. So.
Yes, they did. They did. And where can people get in contact with the Two Sisters Bookstore?
So we are on 193 Fort Wayne Avenue here in Richmond, Indiana, where you can find my sister's books and my shrine to Sherlock Holmes in the back of the room.
And who's a part of your shrine?
And Matt is actually here as a part of the shrine as Professor Moriarty.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. Well, now that we've run back to Sherlock Holmes, I want to say here on Film Sociology, it's sort of a Film Sociology exclusive. You are making your directing debut at the beginning of 2023.
I am, yes, at the Richmond Civic Theater. They are nice enough or crazy enough to allow me to direct the play Miss Holmes, which is a play that the basis of which is what if Holmes and Watson were women back in the Victorian era. So that'll be in January of 2023.
So you can look at gorct.org for more information on that. There might be a cameo by a certain someone. You just have to wait and see.
It's not Cumberbatch.
I'm cheaper. No, I mean the special guest is cheaper. So, on top of everything else, Patty, what movies have you been watching recently that don't involve Sherlock Holmes and heart rippings?
I've been doing my other job, my archaeology job. So I actually have not been watching a lot of films lately, though I have been watching the Kenobi series.
Okay, and?
Oh gosh, it's awesome. I absolutely love it. Whoever was in charge of casting Ewan McGregor way back when, like, deserves an award. they've done a phenomenal job with that show. Let's see, what else have I saw? watched recently?
Well, while you're thinking of that, that reminded me of in the early stages of the internet, friends. I learned well, and this is where I've come up with the idea of I don't care what's in negotiations until I see a poster or a trailer. I don't care. And I'm also reaching the point until I sit down in the theater, it goes dark and the movie starts. I don't care. Because I had two basement-dwelling friends in the 90s who almost came to blows because one was convinced and was trying to convince the other that Kenneth Branagh was going to play young Obi-Wan in the second trilogy. So, and look what happened. Everything's fine. You know,
I mean, they did get a Shakespearean actor.
Well, that's right, a Shakespeare. But it was, you know, this is the same thing where Freddy versus Jason and Alien versus Predator had been in discussions and development hell for over a decade. And then, you know, of the three rumors that happened, the Ewan McGregor as Obi-Wan probably definitely turned out the best.
Oh gosh, yes. No, he is absolutely phenomenal as this character. Yeah, they're really fun. I will not spoil anything that happens in this, like, the TV series for people who are listening, but it is well done and people should check it out.
There you go. So, all right. So yeah. So you're free from Diggs for now.
Yes. Yeah. At least as far as I'm aware.
Okay. So just, well, I know it's kind of like a doctor on call. There's always a phone, you know, so make sure you always have your movie glasses and always pull your hair back when you're digging.
Yes.
So that's a reference to the art film The Dig. If you go see it, you'll see Pamela Anderson in glasses. And now that I'm mixing all the references, you'll just have to check it out for yourself.
It is a good film, too.
Yes,
really
it is. Patty, appreciate your time, and you know, go on down to the two sisters and tell her. Oh, wait a minute! I remember. Didn't you have a? We won't name the person, but didn't you have a young 20-something customer Star Wars splain in your presence?
Yes, we did.
We'll end on this.
There's another one of our customers who's going through. One of our regulars who's going through all the old Star Wars novels. And while he was purchasing one, we had a. Actually, the guy was in his 30s.
Okay.
But yeah, 30-year-old guy come up and start, like, explaining Star Wars to me. which, if you have not been in The Two Sisters, I have a little, like, cutout picture of Luke Skywalker behind the counter, and then I've got, like, a little statuette of Rey, like, above the counter.
Kind of a dead giveaway.
It's kind of a dead giveaway, but I do actually know what Star Wars is. Also, I'm, you know, a person living in America within the past, you know, since 1977. I know what Star Wars is. And yeah, the guy starts explaining Star Wars to me and all this different stuff. And my sister and I have come up with a good response, which is from this point on, whenever somebody attempts to do that, to just respond with, oh, Star Wars, you mean the Space Wizard movie for kids? Yes.
Wow.
Yeah. Like, adore Star Wars, but like, chill.
Actually, that should that should be the subhead for the two sisters. ... Just chill.
Chill, please. Yeah, it was very strange.
So next time you go to the two sisters, friends, just chill. Have a cup of tea, look around, and just chill.
Just chill.
Thank you, Patty.
Oh, thank you for having me.
That's Patty Glenn, co-owner of the Two Sisters Bookstore. Miss Holmes runs this weekend and next weekend at Richmond Civic Theater in Richmond, Indiana. Go to gorct.org for tickets and information. It's going to be a lot of fun. All right, friends, some words to live by.
Silent breed is people!
Zardoz has spoken.
Go see a good movie. You deserve it. There's plenty out there. Next week, a film is opening that is going to change my top 10. I told you this happens sometimes. So keep watching good films, and we'll chat again next week. Thank you for listening. You're listening to Film Sociology, a film podcast here at WFYI.org. Good afternoon, Fort Myers. Good afternoon, California. Good afternoon, Michigan.
I can't believe you let her watch Manos.
Is she scarred for life?
Let's put it this way.
What parent are you?
When I wake her up, I vocalize the theme to wake her up to get her ready to school.
Oh, you're a terrible father.
Okay. We'll do it live.
Okay.
We'll do it live!